No sé lo que pasó. Am I doing enough for my people? Am I doing enough? Am I doing enough para la gente?
Para la gente.
Para mi gente.
Para la gente.
Para mi gente.
Para la gente.
This is Radio Free Aslan, broadcasting from occupied territory.
Welcome back from the northern borderlands of Detroit, Michigan. Again all week, the XCC and the RPMA will be conducting joint podcasts from the U.S. Social Forum. Your host, Jose G. Moreno, will continue with his second segment of Radio Free Aslan on human rights, organizational building, labor production, and new migration trends and destinations within the Mexican Latino population of the U.S. Empire. In segment two, I will interview two human rights and social justice organizers that have been involved in the forefront of the Mexican Latino immigrant rights movement in the U.S. Empire.
Okay.
Please. My name is Francisco Chavo Romero. I am from Oxnard, California, a member of Unión del Barrio, Committee on Racial Rights, Oxnard.
My name is Pedro Rios. I'm the director of the American Friends Service Committee in San Diego, California.
Since the aftermath of the U.S.-Mexican War and the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, Mexican Latinos have been used as cheap labor production for the U.S. imperialist class. What is your perspective on Mexican Latino working class labor production? How has Mexicans and Latinos been struggling against this labor oppression?
From the perspective of the work that we do around migration issues, I think it's important to highlight that the Mexican community, specifically in San Diego, but more generally in the Southwest region, are essentially the major source of people who contribute to the economies locally, regionally, statewide, and nationally. And I think this is why we have to look at migration from the point of view of working class people, because those are the folks who are being exploited. Those are the folks who are essentially working to the bone in order to produce what the large corporations are gaining. And I think from that perspective, then we have to look at how rights are being denied at a much more larger and global level. When you're able to dehumanize a person, then it's easier to trample upon their rights. And when we talk about class struggle, specifically from a Mexican perspective, it has to do directly with how that's taking place systematically in our communities. And so when we do organizing campaigns and support and accompany the organizing in our communities, it's with that in mind to say that people have a right to organize themselves. The Mexican community in San Diego has a right to organize itself in order to offer a different perspective that reclaims their humanity and that uplifts the dignity that is being trampled upon by the forces that that have the wealth. I think when we reframe it that way, we're able to say that the power is in numbers, and if we're able to get our communities organized, then that's how we're able to challenge the power dynamics that maintain this very oppressive system that relegates people to the margins.
Well, since the aftermath of the U.S.-Mexican War of Aggression, meaning the U.S. aggressing towards the Mexicano peoples and taking half of its territory, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo has systematically been violated. In other words, it was never even recognized. And so since that point in time, which was 160 years ago, we see a gradual, either sometimes very small scale, but sometimes at a very large scale, mass attack on our communities. And the attack in the form of breaking our community's ability to organize ourselves, as we had said before, to fight for self-determination, which is supposedly guaranteed in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, fight for our right to our cultura, our language, knowledge of our history. All these things have been systematically taken away, and we've been indoctrinated to accept our colonial status. And so that's been our struggle. It's been our struggle for over 500 years. We know that. But in the recent period, it's been our struggle to recapture our history, to recapture our resources, human and natural, because, you know, the war of aggression wasn't just about, you know, the U.S. expanding from sea to sea, as the song goes, right? The U.S. war of aggression was to take the natural resources and the human resources. So we've been in that struggle since then, and because of the control of our labor, as I mentioned, human resource, right? It's our labor, it's our mano de obra, our work. Our work is what makes this system keep us in the state of colonial and oppressed state, or what we call a new slave status. By being able to exploit us to the fullest extent possible, even to the point where we're dying and large numbers even trying to find work. And so that's how we've been resisting. We've been organizing ourselves either through community organizations, within the unions, in the schools. We're trying to find whatever space we can to collectively resist our you know, the oppressor trying to disappear us, right?
The U.S. imperialist government has refused to sign the U.N. Human Rights Treaty. Why do you think that they have not signed the Human Rights Treaty? In your perspective, what is the meaning of human rights?
You know, the U.S. government hasn't signed a lot of different covenants and treaties that relate to migration, the protection of migrants and their families. And more specifically, it's that covenant regarding the protection of migrants and their families that the U.S. has not signed. And I think if they sign it, then from a global perspective, they have to be bound by principles that the rest of the world has agreed to. This makes it easier for them, when they haven't signed it, to pass laws, legislation, and other methods to further oppress a group of people that already is marginalized by the system that exists in U.S. culture and U.S. society. So by not signing, they're essentially saying it's okay for us to treat people in such a way where we dehumanize and we can trample upon their rights and essentially put them to work and not have to abide by international law in terms of how people should be treated. So it's convenient for the United States as a government to say we're not going to sign on to something that we then have to be, we can be challenged through international court or through other sorts of international mechanisms to hold the U.S. government accountable for its misactions. I think if we look at the current border policies as an example, it's very clear that there is a systematic process in which mostly workers are being killed as a result of these sorts of border policies that are in place at the U.S.-Mexico border. And so if they were to sign on to an international agreement that protects the workers, migrant workers and their families, then they would have to respond directly to the critiques that people are dying at the deserts and in the mountains as a result of these policies that they themselves have put in place. I think the question of what the meaning of human rights is, it's a very large question. It's how we define human rights is barely beginning to be defined within a context over the past 60 years since the signing of the Declaration for Human Rights. But human rights has been something that follows a legacy of struggles of a lot of different people. I think we begin to frame it as a human rights context, but for many years, even before that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of a lot of popular movements that gave us direction and showed us a way to challenge oppressive systems, whether it be here in the Southwest, or not here in the Southwest, but here in the United States or in the Southwest, or in other places as well. When you have a movement for a people's self-determination, that's a human necessity that people are struggling to, and it represents a human right, even though 100, 200, 300 years ago, it wasn't called the struggle for human rights. Now we give it this context. It's a human rights struggle. And I think we frame it that way, but we have to also be conscious that what we're struggling for is liberation, and how we define that liberation, whether it's framed within a human rights context, which is a really good framing to do so. I think we can't lose sight that what we're really struggling for is liberation.
The only thing I would add to that, and I appreciate the comments my colleague here has added, is the U.S. Constitution itself guarantees none of these things that we're talking about. Doesn't guarantee the right to education, the guarantee the right to culture, doesn't guarantee the right to health care, right? Labor rights are intricately addressed through other, measures. But the reality is that the U.S. Constitution is fundamentally based on a white supremacist, settler, colonial agenda. In other words, when the Constitution, which is supposedly the document that dictates the law of this, quote, land, right, was written by slave owners, right, who would go home and rape their slave women, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, all these alleged heroes in history, are who we're talking about here. These folks were writing that piece of legislation. So it was not based on the right, on human rights. It was based on the right to property. It was based on the right to own, right, and even own humans, right. And at that point, as we know, Mexicanos and indigenous people, because as Mexicanos, we do see ourselves as indigenous people of this continent. We were animals, right, and savages. And here, African or community slaves, what they were called at that point, were considered property, right, that they owned and they bought and sold like chattel, as slaves, like an auctioning them off, auctioning humans off. So we have to revisit this concept of what is now known as the U.S. Constitution and start having this dialogue about communities, mass communities, organizing ourselves and reconstituting the law of this land to match the Universal Declaration of Human Rights framework, which guarantees us all these basic needs, food, shelter, clothing, education, healthcare. So it's an interesting point that we should come back at one point and further expand on.
Historically, Mexican Latinos have struggled against labor, political, and economical repression in the U.S. Empire. What organizational work your group is doing in the Mexican Latino working class communities? Like V.I. Lenin pointed out in his writings, what needs to be done to change the political and economical conditions of Mexican Latino population in the U.S. Empire?
I think, working with the American Friends Service Committee, obviously it's a nonprofit organization, and we are, have to work under a structure that is clearly a structure that doesn't necessarily represent our communities. But within that structure and framework, we're able to work directly with communities. A couple of things that we do. Historically, the AFSC in San Diego has been known for monitoring law enforcement operations and documenting civil and human rights abuses that result from contact between civil society and the law enforcement agencies. So we do that sort of documentation. The other aspect, which I think is more focused on this question, is that we undergo a process of accompanying the communities with whom we work in the overall San Diego region. By accompaniment, what this means is that we support their organizing process by sharing resources, by being a resource to them, by assisting them with strategic questions, providing and opening spaces for communities to meet, to organize themselves, to develop their own direct agendas that respond to the needs in their communities. I think that's it's just a little grain of sand and in the large beach, that, you know, that could be a lot more that could be done. Given the few resources that we have, I think it's it complements the work in the communities really well. The framework and the methodology of creating human rights committees, I think, has worked well for us. It also has worked well for communities where they're able to develop their own agendas and their own leadership and move forward in such a way that is representative of their needs without there being some sort of imposition from a nonprofit. So I think, you know, we've been able to work well with that methodology. What needs to be done to challenge the political and economic conditions for Mexicanos and Latinos in the U.S. Obviously, you know, we live in the belly of the beast. And I think when we have conversations with our brothers and sisters in Latin America, they'll tell us, you have to organize yourself. You know, you have to do what we're doing down here. And oftentimes, I think that's a direct challenge to us. And it's difficult for us to think, you know, how can we do what other communities have done? You know, how can we do, for example, taking the experience of the Zapatistas, how can we do something that they've done where they have formed their own collective groups and through that collective process are able to challenge a government? I think it's a very slow process. It takes a lot of determination, a lot of commitment. It takes a lot of consciousness building, because you know, we get fed a lot of misinformation. You know, the mainstream media outlets essentially are passing the line that the government feeds them, and so it's very easy for people to get brainwashed in such a way where it's either, you know, people are so concerned or not concerned about the world because they're trying to deal with their, you know, how do they feed their kids, you know, having two jobs and then having other sort of responsibilities, and at the same time, you know, getting stuck and watching novelas or whatever it might be. And so what I think our task is to find those openings where people are able to experience other ways of relating to each other and other ways of communicating with each other where they can see the prospect for real change through community-based organizing. And I think that's where the changes will come for Mexican and Latino population within the U.S., is for people to begin to relate with one another, to challenge the family separation, because that's essentially what happens. You know, you break up families and you start breaking up a society and you start breaking up the networks by which that same community could change their situation. And so directly challenging these attacks in our communities are a way, I think, to challenge U.S. empire from within.
Well, our organization, Unión del Barrio, for 29 years now, has in its own organic, real, what we call dialectical relationship to our conditions, have been working towards developing a program and an organizational plan of action so we can liberate ourselves, because we are a colonized people. As Mexicano, indigenous people, we're a colony of what is now known as the United States. So what is to be done, we believe, is that we need to reunify our communities, meaning reunify Mexico, and Mexico in the sense, Mexico not with the corrupt, you know, just the ugliness of what is the bourgeois, you know, leadership, all of them which are educated in the U.S., by the way. And so, so you know where they're getting their program from, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we're talking about, a Mexico where we're uniting with the hundreds of indigenous communities that live and reside there, that are struggling against this oppressive state known as Mexico and the oppressive state known as the United States. We're talking about a new Mexico. We're talking about a new socialist Mexico. And so in the recent years, Unión del Barrio, we're saying the word socialism, because we see that as the only viable alternative to what currently exists, which is the capitalist imperialist system, which is degrading our environment, which is massacring people around the world through wars of aggression, which is, letting people die, for example, for lack of health care. There's a problem with society. So for the past 29 years, we've been developing this view and this political program. Now, it just didn't come out of nowhere. Our vision and program has come out of years of hard struggle and sacrifice by many people, not just our own members of Unión del Barrio, but like a historical legacy which we could trace back to the indigenous people, the Mexica that were fighting the Spaniards, and to fast forward all the way to today with the Migra Border Patrol shooting kids at the border, 14-year-old kids at the border. And so we're connected to this movimiento por la liberación. We at Unión del Barrio came out of the ashes of what was essentially a military attack, military counterintelligence program, right? The COINTELPRO, which was an exacted science of repression against any anti-colonial struggles that were being waged within these territories, whether it was the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, Brown Berets, et cetera, American Indian Movement. And so out of that destruction and derailment, because some folks survived, we survived. And we came out of that. Unión del Barrio then began to develop an action plan to keep movement organizing on the street, on the ground, which is where we're going to be struggling this war out, right? We're going to be waging the struggle for humanity out. And since then, we then moved into like an ideological development stage where we're talking about what is our ideology? How do we unite as raza, as Mexicano indigenous people with other working class people? And to end, I'm going to say that we're doing it by doing actions and organizing on the ground through our work with the prisons, with the youth, with the mujer, and with the media.
During the last 30 years, Mexicanos, migration trends, and destinations have changed. For example, there are larger pockets of Mexican Latinos settling in U.S. Southeast, Midwest, Pacific Northwest, and Northeast. However, for the last 100 years, there has been small pockets of Mexican Latinos in the U.S. Midwest, Pacific Northwest, and Northeast. In your opinion, why has Mexican Latino migration trends and destinations have changed? What is the root of this migration change? How this new trend has changed the cultural and political demographics of the U.S. empire?
Well, I think it's important that you frame the question within the past 30 years, because I think that the democratic changes have been quite significant, and they respond, of course, to what I would say advanced capitalism in terms of neoliberal political and economic policies that are being pushed onto countries of origin or communities of origin that then people who have no other choice but to be able to sustain their families have to make that very difficult but dignified choice of saying, I'm going to migrate so I can feed my family, put food on the table. And so the demographic changes are quite significant, especially in the southeast part of the United States, where there have been a lot more migration patterns going into those areas. But I think that it's important also to say that not only are they responding to these sort of economic situations, but then we have a responsibility here, and I think people in general have a responsibility to ensure that just because they're moving into other areas where traditionally they haven't been there, the fact is I think that there have always been communities that have been in those areas that have reflected in one way or another a community that has faced challenges. We have a lot to learn from and a lot to share with our African brothers and sisters who find themselves in those parts of the country. We have a lot to learn from and a lot to share with other communities of color that have experienced their own sets of repressive regimes during the course of U.S. history. And so I think the cultural and political trends are very important for us to follow and respond to, but also ensure that there's the voices from people who are migrating are also included, that they have a seat at the table, that they are offering their opinions to ensure that this process is as transparent and as holistic as it can be in terms of responding to the needs of people in the different areas of the U.S.
In regards to the what essentially really is a global migration situation where people are being forced to move from their traditional homelands to find jobs, right, so they could feed their children, because that's what we're talking about here, right? Is how do we keep our families alive? And so you have this global trend, and so within this global trend, this continent is impacted, and we kind of have to maybe consider looking at this as a really like an internal mass economic refugee situation, right? Where the capitalists are coming in and destroying communities, their local economic development, and forcing them into situations where they have to work in a factory, getting paid slave wages, where they barely even have enough to send back to the country they came from. And so we're moving around a lot because as humans, we've done that forever, right? And so that's what moves us. That's what the global migration patterns have been having. Now the problem is that you have a state that comes in and puts borders and imposes them and kills us at those borders to try to control our ability to migrate as humans and take care of each other. And in that migration, we're going to bump into people. Obviously, the U.S. has a particular unique situation, at least for this side of the continent, because we have immigrants. Well, we consider ourselves migrants, right? Mexicano, indigenous people, migrants, because we migrate on our own territories. But you do have immigrants that have come from Southeast Asia, from Africa, from from other parts of the world that we have to... And you know, but I want to mention here that at first our relationship to Africans didn't just start, you know, recently. We were brought into a relationship because our brothers and sisters were forced to come here at first, right, as slaves. And so now we have a situation where we have to start looking at each other as workers, right, with particular sets of history and culture. But then how do we as workers, Mexicano, indigenous, or raza, Latino, Americanos, relate to African workers, to the Southeast Asian workers, to all these oppressed colonial migrants that have come, immigrants that have come, and even with poor white communities, right? And so once we are able to have that dialogue and come up with the actual working class unity program outside of the Republicans and Democratic parties and the unions they control, that's when we're going to begin to the next phase of our struggle, because this revolution, which is what we're talking about, a change, complete change in society, is inevitable. Now it's the way of how we're going to get there.
I think it's important for us to be here at the U.S. Social Forum because it's a forum where we are able to learn from each other, learn about each other's struggles, and share strategies. And I think that it's important because we don't really have much time, or we don't have time to waste. You know, the struggles that we're dealing with are we're dealing with a much more stringent militarism in our communities that are responding to and depend on a capitalist regime. And so capitalism mixed with militarism is really an equation that will create much worse conditions in our communities. So I think it's important to have the space to dialogue about these sorts of issues. So I want to also just thank Radio Free Aslan for this opportunity to be able to share some thoughts on these very important issues and themes that we're confronting with on a daily basis.
Yes, I want to also thank the Radio Free Aslan, Raza Press and Media Association, the Chicano Development Center, the work that's being done, because it is media. Well, media is one space that we need to begin to really master, because it's through media. The way that we're colonized is because we're being controlled through textbooks and curriculum in the schools, through the mass corporate media and all their shows, the spectacle, the distraction from being able to sit down and think and talk with each other. That's why this U.S. Social Forum is so important. And lastly, the time The time is now to join the struggle. The time, if you're not part of an organization, we want you to join an organization or form an organization in whichever community is, because you're not going to solve this on your own. So with that, I just want to say that we just want to say that as Mexicano indigenous peoples, we are absolved, right, completely of any state of presumed criminality or what they're calling illegality. Illegals. We are not illegals on our own land. So we want to go out and have people consider and begin to dialogue about that reality, that that we're being pit against each other to settle for crumbs known as immigration reform, where we need to demand that we be recognized as indigenous communities, Mexicano communities, full human and dignified rights be restored back to our communities. And the way we're going to do that is through organization. Muchas gracias.
First of all, I would like to thank our speakers for a wonderful critical examination on human rights, organizational billing, labor production, and new migration trends and destinations within the Mexican Latino population of the U.S. Empire. To sum up this segment is to point out that only a counter-hegemonic, anti-privileged, anti-capitalist, anti-colonial struggle will change the social and political conditions for Mexican Latinos living in Las Americas. In closing, this is the only way that another world is possible and a reality in the U.S. Empire. Like the late legendary journalist Evermore would say, good night and good luck.
This monthly podcast is brought to you by the Chicano Development Center, a 501c3 nonprofit organization dedicated to education and political empowerment through grassroots coalition building. We believe in the indigenous sovereignty of the Chicano people in the United States, and that true social and political change begins with the people. Our style of low-intensity organizing endeavors to build intentional communities within greater communities. The motivating force behind low-intensity organizing is to constantly challenge the status quo as to the treatment and economic status, not only of Chicanos and other indigenous people, but of all oppressed people. At the Chicano Development Center, we believe that resistance begins with education, organization, and preparation. We believe that raza must take action on a regular basis, not just in times of crisis.
Love the best.